This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's time for the New Yorker. Since 1925, it's been the world's source for the finest in art and fiction, sophisticated reviews, humor, commentary, and news. Stay tuned for this week's Culture Blast from the one and only New Yorker, right now on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is the New Yorker, and I'm your reader, Dale, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the New Yorker's edition dated April 1st, 2024. And now, I'll begin with the talk of the town. Comment, the next abortion battle. The briefs that the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine has filed with the Supreme Court in its effort to restrict access to mifepristone, a drug that has been used for decades with demonstrated safety in medical abortions, contains some remarkably dubious assertions. One is that the justices are only being asked to uphold a very modest lower court order. That decision would undo a series of rule changes made by the Food and Drug Administration, which approved mifepristone in 2000, beginning in 2016, that increased the drug's availability. Women will still have access to chemical abortion under the same protections that existed for the first 16 years of mifepristone's use, the AHHM writes. This is, of course, nonsense, as both the AHHM and the justices who will hear oral arguments in the case on Tuesday know quite well. Women in the United States do not have the same access to any type of abortion that they did in 2016. In March 2016, when the FDA made the first of the rule changes that the AHM, a medical group whose members, it says, oppose abortion with purity and holiness, is challenging, Donald Trump had not yet secured the Republican nomination, let alone appointed three justices. As president, he made the court even as he transformed his he remade the court even as he transformed his party. We now live in a reality shaped not by Roe v. Wade, but by Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, the 2022 decision that found that there is no constitutional right to abortion. Questions about reproductive health are being decided in a judicial and political atmosphere tinged with Trumpism, unrestrained and heedless of compassion. Most commonly, mifepristone, also called RU486, the abortion pill, is used in combination with a second drug, misoprostol, which helps to complete the process. Until 2016, the FDA had approved mifepristone's use only up to the seventh week of pregnancy. That was expanded to 10 weeks. At the same time, the FDA reduced the number of clinical visits required for a medical abortion from 3 to 1 and allowed licensed medical professionals who are not doctors, such as nurse practitioners, to prescribe abortion pills. States can write stricter rules. In 2021, in the midst of the pandemic, the FDA began permitting the clinical visit to take place via telemedicine and pharmacies to deliver the pills by mail. These adjustments would make sense in any context. They were based on a battery of studies encompassing tens of thousands of people and on the real-world experience of millions, all of which showed that the associated risks are extremely low. According to an amicus brief from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and other groups, mifepristone has a safety profile comparable to that of ibuprofen. The ACOG brief also emphasizes that easier access is crucial to low-income and rural patients, many of whom live in what are called maternity care deserts. Entire stretches of the country are now undergoing rapid desertification in terms of reproductive health. A study released last week by the Guttmacher Institute shows how the terrain is shifting and how people are trying to find their way through the land of Dobbs. 14 states, including Texas, Missouri, and Indiana, have banned almost all abortions. Guttmacher found that in states that bordered those 14, the number of abortions in the formal medical system had increased by 37% since 2020. Nationally, the increase was 10%. That number suggests that Dobbs has levied a travel tax. Guttmacher estimates that 160,000 people crossed state lines to obtain an abortion last year. The Guttmacher report demonstrates how essential mifepristone is. Between 2020 and 2023, the proportion of medical abortions rose from 53% to 63%. In 2014, the number was 31%. Guttmacher cited a study finding that online-only providers now account for 8% of abortions. Telemedicine is not a panacea. Pharmacies cannot mail the pills to or even within every state, and some people would prefer to be cared for in person. And 10 weeks is still a relatively narrow window, but more access helps. It's the stubborn endurance of that potential for choice, rather than any fear about medical safety, that appears to lie behind lawsuits such as that of the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. The group says on its website that its members are committed to protecting life from the moment of fertilization. That credo is a reminder that the fight is not only about abortion, but about many forms of contraception and miscarriage care. And, as evidenced by recent court rulings on fetal personhood in Alabama, the availability of IVF. The litigation demonstrates, too, the falsity of the idea that Dobbs would simply return the question of abortion to the states. The mifepristone case emerged from the Fifth Circuit, which, as Vox put it, has become the nation's Trumpiest court. Still, it is shocking that the case has come this far. To bring a suit, parties are supposed to show standing, meaning that they have been harmed in some direct way that a court can remedy. The AHM's contention is that some of its members are doctors who theoretically might encounter patients in an emergency room who needed care after taking mifepristone and be forced to treat them in some manner that could violate those doctors' consciences. It's not clear that this has ever happened. The AHM also argues that treating these patients would divert time and resources from those its members do approve of. Normally, the court asks for far more than such speculation to establish harm. If, nonetheless, the court finds that the AHM has standing, the most vulnerable provisions will be the ones allowing for by-mail prescriptions and perhaps telemedicine. Their fate would depend on whether the justices read an 1873 law known as the Comstock Act as banning the mailing of medications used for any abortion or only for an illegal one. 145 Republican senators and representatives submitted an amicus brief in support of the AHM. Meanwhile, 263 Democratic members of Congress submitted a brief supporting the FDA and continued broad access to mifepristone. Those dueling briefs reflect a growing divide on reproductive rights between the parties, if not their voters. Polls continue to show that a majority of Americans support access to abortion with some limits. And, as was the case in 2016, both Trump and reproductive rights are on the ballot. And that article was written by Amy Davidson Sorkin. The next article, Trailblazers Department, Unbossed. When the actor Regina King was growing up in Los Angeles, she would tell people that she was related to Martin Luther King Jr. "My birthday is the same as Dr. King's," she explained recently. Congress made the date a federal holiday in 1983 after years of lobbying led by Coretta Scott King. But Regina King started going to elementary school in the 1970s. "I got away with it for three grades to get out of doing things in school," she said. "My family, they've been working so hard to make my uncle's birthday a national holiday, and the government just doesn't cooperate. My teachers would be like, 'You poor child.' Maybe that was my first moment of subconsciously showing that I could be an actor." King has won an Oscar, a Golden Globe, and four Emmys. She has starred in a wide range of movies and TV shows, including If Beale Street Could Talk, The Leftovers, 7 Seconds, and American Crime. She also voiced two characters on The Boondocks, an animated series that often satirized Black political figures, including MLK himself. King's latest film is Shirley, now streaming on Netflix, about Shirley Chisholm, the first Black congresswoman from Brooklyn, who in 1972 also became the first Black person and the first woman to run for the Democratic presidential nomination. She lost handily in the primary to George McGovern, who went on to lose handily to Richard Nixon. King plays Chisholm and produced the movie with her sister Rena, a process that took 15 years. King said they made the movie because they were tired of people not knowing who Chisholm was. In 2019, Governor Andrew Cuomo unveiled Shirley Chisholm State Park in Brooklyn, 400 acres on the northern shore of Jamaica Bay. Although the park has some views of the Manhattan skyline, it's mostly just a big open field with brown grasses and a series of gravel paths. Planes constantly roar overhead. JFK Airport is not far away. During a recent trip to New York, King visited the park. It was largely deserted. "Very cool that Brooklyn did this for her," King said. She wore a black jumpsuit and sneakers. King inspected a chalkboard sign at the entrance. No BBQ, no pets, no motor vehicles. King looked slightly disturbed. "No barbecue," she said. "Oh, maybe no barbecuing." My mind went straight to, like, that's racial. She headed down Red Tail Trail on the western side of the park. Every now and then, she'd pass a sign with a Chisholm quote such as, "Be as bold as the first man or woman to eat an oyster." King first heard about Chisholm in school during Black History Month. The teachers would choose a Black hero each day to celebrate for 2 minutes of the curriculum, she said. Through the years, King watched other politicians characterize themselves as trailblazers, arguably at the expense of Chisholm's legacy. In 1984, Jesse Jackson became the second African American to run for the Democratic nomination. Raina and I were like, "Oh, I guess he's not going to say anything about Shirley." "Okay," King said. Same goes for Hillary Clinton. When Clinton ran for the Democratic nomination in 2016, King was working on the script for the biopic. She thought about including a modern-day scene in which a Black reporter asked Clinton about her political journey. "We were going to have Hillary mention Shirley Chisholm because we hadn't heard Shirley mentioned," King said. "We were like, okay, we're going to do you a favor, Hillary." In recent years, Vice President Kamala Harris has paid tribute to Chisholm, referring to her in speeches and even adopting some of Chisholm's campaign imagery. "One thing about Shirley, and this is no disrespect to Kamala, is that Shirley was really big on no gimmicks," King said. Her slogan was, "Unbought and unbossed." Shirley was just unapologetically Shirley. She suddenly shifted into Shirley voice. "Either you like me or you don't." The congresswoman's accent was a mix of Brooklyn and Bajan, which took King a year to master. "I find myself slipping into it sometimes," King said. On Red Tail Trail, two women went sprinting by, the first signs of life in the park. "Let's go," a man shouted from a distance. "You want to get medals." The man seemed to be their coach, or their overbearing father, or both. He berated them for slowing down. "Jog properly," he yelled several times. He sounded Jamaican. "I love it," King said. She said it was only right to encounter that accent and that work ethic in Chisholm's park. A few minutes later, there was another sign of life. A huge rodent darted across the trail and burrowed into the ground. A sign near the burrow explained that the park was built on the site of the former Pennsylvania Avenue landfill. "Oh, so Shirley gets a landfill," King said, shaking her head. "Still, you gotta appreciate the beauty in the bruises." And that article was written by Tyler Fogott. And now, Letter from Montgomery. The Art of Memory. An ambitious new park attempts to tell the history of slavery through sculpture. And this article was written by Doreen St. Philly. The National Monument to Freedom in Montgomery, Alabama, is a giant book standing 43 feet high and 150 feet wide. The book is propped wide open, and engraved on its surface are the names of more than 120,000 black people documented in the 1870 census who were emancipated after the Civil War. On the spine of the book is a credo written for the dead. Your children love you. The country you built must honor you. We acknowledge the tragedy of your enslavement. We commit to advancing freedom in your name. The history of slavery is one of elisions and silences of moving on. The civil rights attorney, Brian Stevenson, who designed the monument, has taken a different approach, displaying the realities of enslavement on a monumental scale. His colossal book is the centerpiece of the Freedom Monument Sculpture Park, which opens in late March. Set on a high bluff overlooking the Alabama River, the park presents a painstaking narrative history of slavery using first-person recollections, historical artifacts, and more than 50 sculptures. The park is the third site in Montgomery created in recent years by Stevenson and his legal nonprofit, the Equal Justice Initiative. In 2018, EJI opened the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, dedicated to the victims of lynching, and the Legacy Museum. The memorial, which sits at a high point of downtown Montgomery, towers over the rest of the city, making the state capitol look like a toy in comparison. It consists of more than 800 6-foot-long hanging columns, each inscribed with the name of a county, its documented victims, and the dates when they were murdered. At first, the columns are at eye level, but as you walk through the space, the ground slopes downward until the columns are above your head. They are made of cord and steel, which rusts continuously. When it rains, the water runs red on the rusted columns as if it were blood. The past decade has seen a surge in public art and educational institutions centered on Black history. The most prominent is the National Museum of African American History and Culture, colloquially known as the Blacksonian, which became a permanent institution in Washington, D.C. in 2016. The museum sticks out on the National Mall. It is a 3-tiered glass structure covered in bronze metalwork that evokes the crowns used in West African art. Most of its significance is in its location, a temple to Black survival, a stone's throw from the country's halls of power. As a government institution, the Blacksonian also lends a kind of penance to a guilty state. EJI receives no public funding for the Legacy Museum, the Lynching Memorial, or the Sculpture Park, which together are known as the Legacy Sites. They are an indictment of Montgomery, a former capital of the domestic slave trade. The sites are angry and mournful. Their invocations of peace, justice, and freedom are not banal. The Legacy Museum is a museum in name only. Though it contains some artifacts, such as jars of soil collected from lynching sites, they serve mostly to enhance the main display, which is text. I am not as interested in object and artifact, mostly because I don't think it has the same narrative power, Stevenson told me. Or at least you have to provide a narration so it's not easily misinterpreted. Stevenson incorporates video and even holograms into the exhibits, creating a black box theater experience in order to tell an epic story, the evolution of anti-black violence in America, from the transatlantic slave trade to Jim Crow terrorism and today's mass incarceration crisis. The museum is an analog to the Times 1619 Project, a sweeping public chronicle of an alternative origin story for our country. The Freedom Monument Sculpture Park is more of a period piece. Like the Legacy Museum, it thwarts our tendency to see slavery from the vantage of the freed. It sticks narrowly to enslavement, concluding with the aftermath of the Civil War. It is also a feat of contemporary art acquisition, containing works by the likes of Simone Lay, Hank Willis Thomas, Allison Saar, Charles Gaines, and Nikisha Breeze. The sculptures give the park a straightforward visual appeal. This is the one legacy site that you would not hesitate to call beautiful. But as you attempt to take in the art, an active rail line originally built by the enslaved to cart in more of the enslaved makes noise nearby. It can be difficult to tell the difference between the art and the artifacts. An object that from a distance looks like an abstract sculpture reveals itself to be a whipping post driven into the dirt. The atmosphere at the park is that of a necropolis. You enter under an arch and encounter a placard that asks for your quiet and your attention. Stevenson has designed a kind of passion walk, a circular path through the woods punctuated by art, artifact, and text. It begins before America began, with a section devoted to Alabama's indigenous history, followed by a slow anatomization of the transatlantic slave trade and life in enslavement. The path culminates in the National Monument to Freedom, which is grandly literal, impossible to misinterpret. Visitors can use an app to locate their own surnames on the surface, making the monument a living archive. Walking through the grounds, I thought of the black philosopher Fred Moten, who, like Stevenson, slips in and out of the art world. Moten once said that he wanted to practice curation, not as a bureaucrat, but as a curate, a priest who tends to the questions of the lowest in society. Stevenson told me that the goal of the park was to create a narrative about the history of slavery in a historically authentic space without any distractions. And then the idea to mix it with sculpture was to make it a little bit more accessible. The museum has a lot of reading. Even the lynching memorial was kind of abstracted. I said, this will be a little easier. I'm not sure that's true. When the Freedom Monument Sculpture Park opens to visitors, the difficulty will be the point. History has become mythology in Alabama. Montgomery is a monument to both the civil rights movement and the Confederacy. Mourners of Martin Luther King Jr. flock to the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church to see the pastor's wooden pulpit. Lovers of Confederate Americana, meanwhile, genuflect at the first White House of the Confederacy. The city is littered with Confederate statues, soldiers, pretentious obelisks. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are 58 Confederate monuments across the state. Most of them were erected not in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, but during Reconstruction and the Jim Crow era, acting as deterrents to burgeoning black self-determination. The Confederate Memorial, Monument, and 88-foot column outside the Capitol featuring a triumphant goddess dates from 1898. For much of its life, the monument has been flanked by four large Confederate flags. I don't think that those of us who would like to see all the stone soldiers fall are conceding much if we admit that most monuments, especially those on street corners or in traffic circles, don't constantly prompt us to think about history. They don't always cause offense. They exist in their everyday life, to paraphrase Andrew Shankin, a scholar of memorialization, as street furniture. Until hatred or love activates the stone. In 2015, Dylan Roof visited various Confederate monuments in South Carolina before walking into the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, where he shot and killed 9 black people in cold blood. This spurred a national reckoning over Confederate imagery in public spaces. A week after the shooting, Alabama's governor ordered the removal of the flags surrounding the Confederate Memorial Monument. Many people called for the removal of the monument altogether. Gerald Allen, a state senator from Tuscaloosa, sponsored the Memorial Preservation Act, which prevents any Alabama monument that's more than 40 years old from being relocated, removed, or destroyed. It became law in 2017. Protesters defied it, as did public officials. The mayor of Birmingham, a young black man named Randall Woodfin, secreted away a Confederate obelisk from Lynn Park to an undisclosed location and gladly accepted the fine, $25,000, when the state sued Birmingham. In 2019, Montgomery elected its first black mayor, Stephen Reed. He comes from local civil rights stock. His father participated in lunch counter sit-ins and has chaired the Alabama Democratic Conference since 1979. While in office, Reed has called for the renaming of high schools and streets for civil rights heroes. History haunts, the scholar Imani Perry has written, but Alabama changes. Reed and Woodfin are seen as visionaries of the New South, a South where both the government and the monuments reflect the Black constituency. Stevenson, too, is part of this movement. He arrived in Montgomery in the late 80s, then a staff attorney with the Southern Center for Human Rights. At the time, Stevenson's focus was not on Alabama's public art landscape, but on its legal one, namely the state's death row system, and he and his colleagues spent decades fighting to reform it. Still, Alabama condemns more people to death than almost any other state. In 1989, Stevenson founded EJI, which offers legal representation to anyone on death row. The organization also has a research arm rivaling that of small universities focused on documenting the history of racial injustice. In addition to handling capital cases, Stevenson has argued 6 times before the Supreme Court, including in a landmark case in 2012 that outlawed mandatory life sentences for juveniles without parole. In 2014, he published a memoir, Just Mercy, about his experiences defending the imprisoned and condemned, as he called his calls his clients. The book was later adapted into a film in which Michael B. Jordan plays Stevenson. Along with the legal scholar Michelle Alexander, Stevenson is arguably the reason why many Americans have at least some understanding of mass incarceration. But now, at the age of 64, he is watching the courts regress. When Stevenson was a child in rural Delaware, he witnessed lawyers arriving in town to fight segregation. He believes that if Brown v. Board of Education were in front of the Supreme Court today, it would not result in the same ruling. I met with Stevenson at EJI one morning in February. He had come into the office with the sun. Tall, thin, and bald, he has been compared to both a monk and a preacher. A couple of weeks prior, the state had strapped a gas mask on a death row inmate named Kenneth Smith. Kenny, as he was known to Stevenson, who consulted with Smith's lawyers, and pumped nitrogen gas into his lungs. This method of execution, which causes hypoxia, has not been used by any other state. I realized we have to get outside of the court and start engaging in a narrative struggle that allows our work inside the court to remain effective, Stevenson told me. He started with a street marker. In 2013, he submitted a request to a local historical organization to place an acknowledgement of the city's slave trade on the sidewalk outside the EJI office, a former warehouse for the enslaved. The organization denied the request. Stevenson instead partnered with the city to get the marker placed. Downtown Montgomery is in the midst of a revitalization. EJI has fueled some of the changes, helping to transform areas of the city and attracting throngs of out-of-town visitors. When I landed at the Montgomery Airport, the first tourism advertisement I saw was for the Legacy Museum. Several hotels have opened since the first 2 legacy sites were built. It is now difficult to get a restaurant reservation downtown. I saw tourist buses full of groups from churches, Black fraternities, and schools. It is not uncommon to see soldiers at the sites visiting from the nearby Maxwell Air Force Base. Most of the people I met in Montgomery praised Stevenson and his revision of the area's antebellum face, but some obstacles remain. As we drove through downtown, Stevenson pointed out several lots that landowners had refused to sell to him or had offered at an obscene markup. There is plenty of abandoned land in Montgomery, and you typically don't need a lot of money to buy it. To get around sellers who might be eager to capitalize on his relative celebrity, Stevenson has created a system of LLCs, allowing EJI to acquire the land needed for its sites under different names. He sometimes sends young white men from his office to scope out potential property. One night in Montgomery, I went to a restaurant where I sat at the bar. To my right was a man drinking wine and eating fries. He was a retired prosecutor. He asked me why I was in town, and when I told him, he placed a swollen crimson palm on mine. "Sweetie," he said, "I think Bryant is a great salesman." The prosecutor had litigated the cases of many people on death row. He told me that there are monsters in this land and that they do not deserve to walk among us. He did not see the necessity of the legacy sites, which he had never visited because Alabama, he told me, had already dealt with all that. Stevenson drew inspiration for the legacy sites from museums and art exhibitions around the world. He went to Storm King, where he fell in love with Wangechi Mutu's Into Canoe, a sculpture of tree-like bodies in a boat. Mutu was born in Kenya and now lives in America. Her piece is fantasy and history intertwined, an imaginative reframing of travel across the Atlantic. Stevenson flew to Venice for the 2022 biennial, where he encountered Simone Leys' Brick House, which has a black woman's face and a body resembling a vessel or a shelter. The sculpture is imperious and has no eyes. Stevenson told me that the piece reminds him of his late grandmother. On a visit to South Africa, he found himself drawn to the immersiveness of the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg. Visitors are randomly assigned white or non-white and then enter the museum through the corresponding door. He recalled of his visit, "The Swedish lawyers who are with me are like, oh, this feels uncomfortable. We don't want to go through the white door." The black woman at the counter replied, "You are at the Apartheid Museum. You can take that ticket and go through the door, or you can go back to Sweden." He also visited the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe in Berlin, which consists of thousands of concrete slabs. The memorial is accompanied by a museum or a place of information which holds the names of Holocaust victims. "There were no words," Stevenson said of the memorial. They trusted people to come into this relatively abstract cultural space with a knowledge of the Holocaust that allowed them to have a meaningful engagement with the museum below. After Stevenson surveyed the global range of memorial architecture, he realized that America needed language and story. Art was useful, too, as a handmaiden to the urgent problem of narrative. Even the text-heavy Legacy Museum now has its own art gallery, which serves as a coda, featuring more than 100 works by artists such as Glenn Ligon and Elizabeth Catlett. Tara DuVernay, the Deputy Director of Museum and Memorial Operations at EJI, told me that she and Stevenson were initially wary of the gallery overshadowing the existence of the museum. "In reality, the gallery completes it. I go to other museums and I feel like we're in the game now," DuVernay said. The process of curating the Freedom Monument Sculpture Park was rather informal. Stevenson was already friends with some of the artists, including Hank Willis Thomas, who provided a piece that's on display outside the lynching memorial, "Rise Up," a cement wall with black men emerging from the top, their arms permanently raised in surrender. Other artists went out of their way to work with him. Allison Saar made a new version of her piece, "Tree Souls," that could withstand outdoor installation. Simone Leys loaned Stevenson Brick House. But before visitors can see Brick House, set at the entrance of the park, they are meant to experience the other two legacy sites. It is overwhelming to visit all three in one day. "I started with the Legacy Museum. The crowds can get big," Stevenson told me, "so the museum sometimes features the same exhibit twice, allowing everyone to see everything. I visited on a Monday when the operation is otherwise closed to the public, which made the repetition impossible to escape. I turned to my right in the slave pen room and saw glitching apparition-like holograms of exhausted children calling for their missing mothers. I turned to my left and out rang, "Mama?" again. The lynching memorial, too, employs a sort of doubling. The hanging steel columns are replicated in a separate display outside, flat on the ground. Finally, they have been laid to rest. At the sculpture park, the bluff has been cleared and trimmed, but only to a point. The scenery is meant to approximate what the land might have looked like to those sold down the river. The long circular path that presents itself to you at the start of the park feels like it was dropped from another realm. Medium-sized sculptures come into view, abstracted female forms created by the indigenous artisans Rose B. Simpson and Alan Hauser. Signs explain the violence done by colonists to the indigenous people of Alabama. All around, you hear voices telling family stories in Muscogee, sounds emerging from the brush. Close by are works by Joe Mutasa and Raven de Clark, variations on the figurative bust. Mutasa's piece, African King and Queen, contains photorealistic visages of West African royalty carved from opal stone. The park presents a sense of lost and then recovered Africanness. Back on the path, we are given hard data, information on various human trafficking ports and old slavery laws, which EJI has inscribed on plinths. But one may also leave the narrative drifting off into the mulch toward Benin Strut by Thaddeus Mosley. Mosley, a 97-year-old sculptor, works in the naturalist mode. His sculpture of wooden horns that are curled together like a pair of arms mimics the trees around it. The guiding principle of the park is a kind of reclaimed monumentalism, the black artist taking up space. But Mosley's work does something different. It is the artist behaving furtively, camouflaging himself in the land, denying us full access to his image. The sculptures range from the conceptual to the literal and from the figurative to the narrative. Not all of them work in a compositional way. I'm unsure, for instance, about the massive ball and chain with the cuff cracked open. Some of the pieces are necessarily didactic, commissioned to furnish the script of the path. Kwame Akotobamfo, a Ghanaian artist who has become a sort of house sculptor for EJI, told me that he had no issue with being used as Stevenson's vessel. You get to be a conduit for a vision that is larger than yourself. Visitors will encounter his bronze statues of cotton pickers, their bodies bent over a real cotton field which the EJI team has installed in the dirt. One of the park's goals is immersion, which in other spaces can feel kitschy. Because Stevenson has kept the mood austere with a focus on education, the park's artifacts feel like more than just momentary portals. They are genuine doors to history. The park features former dwellings of the enslaved, which sit at the heart of the park, accessible via a long approach. The dwellings are not the big house that you'd find on a plantation frozen in antebellum glamour. You can walk inside these structures and smell them, see the newspaper used as insulation in the walls. Afterward, you come upon another set of plinths bearing notices from family members who attempted to reconnect with relatives who had been sold. As you walk around the park, the Alabama River looms. So does the sun, which works with the trees to cast shadows on the National Monument to Freedom in the final section of the park. But before there can be freedom, there must be death. An Archaeology of Silence, a sculpture by Kehinde Wiley, stretching more than 17 feet into the air, attacks the clearing with its immensity and its shine. It also attacks the sculptures of horse-riding Confederate soldiers elsewhere in the South. A black man, a modern one wearing sneakers, lies on a horse, lifeless. The sculpture was previously in San Francisco, where it was displayed in a cavernous museum hall. It is far more interesting in Alabama. I can no longer imagine it anywhere else. And now shouts and murmurs. Signs you should give up on a book. And this was written by Gigi Lee. You can't stop thinking about the characters and how you'd like to rewrite them as characters from books you've actually enjoyed reading. You find yourself regularly reaching for the book to squash the silverfish in your apartment. You keep having to reread the first chapter because you've been distracted by an article about Gary Oldman's movies, ranked from best to worst. You're 10 pages into the book and think a murder investigation would really liven things up right about now. You are reading Little Women. You're 20 minutes into reading the book and just now realize you've been asleep the whole time. You're 20 years into reading the book, and it's the only book that hasn't been burned or rewritten by our robot overlords, and yet you still can't seem to get emotionally invested in the story. The book has been described as thrilling and captivating, but by readers who play badminton. You want to stick with the book for the first 100 pages before deciding whether you should abandon it, but at your current pace, it will take you a year to get through a single page. You wait for the book to initiate physical contact. The blurb on the back of the book says, "Does for sawdust what Moby Dick did for whales." You stay up all night tearing through the pages of the book, only you're not reading the actual words, you're just looking for the page in which you tucked a piece of scrap paper with your Gmail password on it. You were thinking about Gary Oldman's understated performance in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which leads you to Google whether he was nominated for an Oscar for that film, which then somehow leads you to click on an article about the best hand creams for mature skin. And now you can't remember what the book is about and have to start over from the beginning. You would rather get into a conversation with your neighbor who likes to go into very specific detail about their meal prep routine before they finally ask, "So what's going on with you?" And their eyes glaze over as soon as you start talking, and so you end up asking them about which vegetables stay fresh the longest in order to re-engage them in the conversation, just to avoid reading your book. You are reading David Copperfield before starting on Demon Copperhead, which was inspired by David Copperfield, because you think this will give you a feeling of accomplishment that will make you feel better about how you've been cold emailing recruiters on LinkedIn for the past year without getting any responses, probably because your only viable skill is reading books you can't seem to finish. There's going to be a film adaptation of the book starring Gary Oldman. You should watch that instead. And now from the critics, the art world. Skin Deep, the hit or miss body art of the Whitney Biennial, and this was written by Jackson Arne. If every label in Even Better Than the Real Thing, the 81st installment of the Whitney Biennial, were peeled off the walls and tossed into the Hudson, what would happen? Some sections would get more confusing, of course. When you walk through the yellow-lit gallery on the museum's sixth floor, you probably wouldn't suppose that the faint buzz came from a live electrical net floating overhead, let alone that the light, the buzz, and the net might represent the tension between disassociation and hypervigilance, according to the piece's artist, P. Staff. Passing the cluster of translucent medicine cabinets, you would know that the buttery stuff inside was Vaseline, and even if you guessed right, you would still be ignorant of the fact that the artist, Carolyn Lazard, went with Vaseline because it is both a lubricant and an occlusive ointment, and thus connected to her interest in the entanglement between illness and capitalism. But in other ways, a label-less biennial might be clearer. The introductory text by the co-curators Chrissy Isles and Meg Onley stresses the point that artificial intelligence is complicating our understanding of what is real. One of the first artworks you see on the sixth floor is, sure enough, an AI-generated print, courtesy of Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst, so it's a letdown to continue through the galleries and find approximately zero other pieces dealing with artificial intelligence. A show purged of wall text wouldn't tease you like that, at least. You would also have an easier time recognizing how many of these works depend on text, not just for background, but for aesthetics. Whatever beauty or humor they've got comes from nearby words, as the glow of the moon comes from the glare of the sun. Is this worth getting grumpy about? You can always scold the Whitney Biennial, the longest-running survey of American art, for not being better, but then you can always scold winter for being cold and gray. Some inevitable combination of bureaucracy, human fallibility, and mathematical law keeps things bland. Each time the curators settle on 60 or 100, or this year, 71 artists whose creations have some relevance to the state of society, as well as to the state of art. Doing that job and not ending up with yawny work would be like rolling double sixes 71 times in a row. This year, as ever, eclecticism is mistaken for richness. Even better than the real thing makes a well-publicized push for geographic diversity, but its most important lesson might be that 21st century art can come from anywhere and still speak in the same jet-lagged monotone. More than a quarter of the artists on display, by the way, went to one of three schools. Assuming that a sample like this can be taken seriously, the most exciting subject for contemporary American artists isn't artificial intelligence. It's the good old human body. Striking and bland artworks alike have a fleshy funk. Ye Phan converts CT scans of his body into dun fiberglass sculptures. In Julia Phillips' ceramic sculptures, the casts hint at a phantom chest and face. A gallery over, Carmen Wynant, mooching off the pathos of the abortion clinic, combines hundreds of photographs of physicians and volunteers into a giant rectangle. Better than all three is Pippa Garner, who in her 80s has been entrusted with the museum's third floor and earns her keep with drawings, reprised here as photocopies, of useless body-augmenting gadgets, a phone holder that allows you to extend with your tongue, a multi-pen for signing checks, a remote control toilet flusher. Spend enough time snorting at these and the body itself starts to seem like another clumsy gadget. Tongue texting may be ridiculous, but so is a tongue. Nothing in these nervous scribbles feels final. Garner, like nature, is always just spitballing, which means that what is earnest and thoughtful about her drawings, many of them produced during her gender transition, is inseparable from what's funny. Good artists, like good comedians, do just fine without the safety net of explication. Look through old catalogs of this show and you will find, amid hundreds of forgotten names, Joseph Cornell, Nam June Paik, Jackson Pollock, Nicole Eisenman, Carrie James Marshall, and Julie Meretu, whether or not any of this year's batch belong on that list, they've contributed enough splashes of wit and visual delight to keep, even better than the real thing, from feeling like a total desert. A silver medal for body comedy goes to Sharon Hayes, whose video piece, Recherche 4, assembles interviews with elderly LGBTQIA Americans about sex and sexuality in the manner of Pasolini's love meetings. Slow going at first, it generates a startling amount of warmth as its subjects confess and blush and chuckle. I still think I'm sexy and I feel sexy, a man in a peach-colored ball cap says, while a chicken scampers behind him. A relaxed front porch sort of charm holds the piece together. But at some point you realize that you're facing maybe half a millennium's worth of combined experience with love. The same laid-back monumentality can be felt in Suzanne Jackson's acrylic gel paintings, sculptures almost, which look like jagged panels of glass that absorb everything they touch. The best ones hang, frameless, in the middle of their room, inviting audiences to inspect them from every angle and ogle the seeds and other odd morsels trapped inside. Think of it as action painting's evil twin, creation as slow, oozy accumulation. Other worthwhile pieces aren't body-related in the slightest, and more power to them. Takako Yamaguchi's abstracted seascapes don't reinvent the wheel, but they're too lush for anyone but the ghost of Clement Greenberg to mind, with a sleekness that smacks of mid-century graphic design. In Nikita Gale's Stolen Time, an old player piano produces no melody, just the tuneless plonks of keys moving down and up. It's a heftier version of 4'33", running where John Cage crawled. The sounds of the keys aren't music, as the word is usually understood, but no pianist could use her instrument without making sounds like these two. When we talk about music, we tend to mean either a score or a physical performance, but we're probably referring to a little of both, with Gale's enhanced sounds being the missing link between them. I can imagine her work giving a copyright attorney an aneurysm. Do its noises constitute a bass line or a melody? Why does the legal system make these kinds of distinctions in the first place? Whose intellectual property are we dealing with? The questions come to you unbidden, no thanks to the prodding of the label, stolen time, might be even stronger without one, actually. Ideas follow from other ideas with the satisfying click of a mathematical proof. I've said it before, conceptual art isn't tedious. Bad conceptual art is. By a close margin, the four fabric assemblages of Harmony Hammond are the fleshiest things in this show. They use a variety of materials to suggest a whole menagerie of bodies, from pimply shiny to aged and chalky. Colors are subdued for the most part, and strategically so, when a touch of red shrieks out of the dirty white field of chenille number 11, it almost hurts. Hammond has suggested that flourishes like this were meant to evoke sexual brutality against women. But take a few steps back and marvel at how this only deepens her work's mystery. If the red is brutality, what are the string, the smeared white, the grommets? Interpretation is interwoven with the sheer, thingy strangeness of the object and can't be ripped out. Art like that is built to last, I would guess. But if you prefer your political messaging neat, no chaser, you are welcome to walk to the other end of the sixth floor, go to the terrace, and spend some quality time with Keon Williams's big dirt sculpture of the White House sinking into the ground, complete with upside-down American flag. There's a label in case you can't figure out what it means. And finishing up today's edition, a book review on a book titled Ashoka, written by Patrick Olivelle and published by Yale. This incisive biography aims to separate the historical Ashoka, who ruled a vast swath of the Indian subcontinent in the 3rd century BC, from the one of legend. Ashoka is commonly described as the Buddhist ruler of India, but in Olivelle's rendering, he is a ruler who happened to be a Buddhist and whose devoutness was only a single aspect of a unique and unprecedented system of governance. Ashoka sought to unite a religiously diverse polyglot people. His most radical innovation, Olivelle shows, was the Dharma community, a top-down effort to give his subjects a sense of belonging to the same moral empire. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Dale with The New Yorker. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.